The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Caro, Part 3. Copyright 1982 by the author. This recording of the reading of The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, was published by arrangement with International Creative Management, Incorporated, and was produced in 1988 by Books on Tape, Incorporated. This book consists of 9 chapters and is 243 pages long. Part 5. New Fields. Chapter 29. Mr. Johnson Goes to Washington. Lyndon Johnson was so energetic and ingenious a congressman that a knowledgeable observer called him the best congressman for a district that ever was. He was, moreover, secure in his congressional seat. In 1938, he would be one of 8 Texas congressmen who did not have an opponent in the Democratic primary or in the general election in November. In 1940, he would again be unopposed. But a congressman was not what Lyndon Johnson wanted to be. No sooner had he won the 10th district seat than he was trying to leave it, as rapidly as possible. On the day after he had been elected to the House of Representatives, while he was still in the hospital recuperating from his appendicitis attack, he had begun preparing for the next step toward his great goal by writing National Youth Administration officials to urge that Jesse Kellum's appointment as Texas NYA director be made permanent. His success in securing that appointment for his loyal number 2 man had ensured that his statewide organization would be kept in place, and he worked continuously to build it up and to utilize it. NYA work was only part of what his NYA men were doing all across Texas. Whenever one visited a town to check on an NYA project, he was supposed also, says one, to go to the courthouse and see the mayor and other local politicians, and to see the school people and the postmasters, who were often key figures in a local political structure. The NYA man was instructed to put in a good word for Congressman Johnson, and to ask if, although Johnson was not the mayor's own congressman, there was any service Johnson could perform for him or for his town. He was also told to keep his ears open for political gossip and report it to the chief. And these reports were not ignored. Says one NYA man, J.J. Jake Pickle, "I would write him long letters, and he would call me about them. He would re-explore what I had said. Why did he say that? Repeat that." The practice in Johnson's Washington office was, moreover, the same now that he was a congressman as it had been when he was a congressional secretary. No matter how busy the office might be, requests from important people, people with money or political clout, from the other 20 congressional districts in Texas were to be given urgent priority. Every Wednesday, the Speaker's dining room on the ground floor of the Capitol was reserved for a luncheon meeting of the Texas congressional delegation. 2 senators, 21 representatives, and, of course, should he want to sit in, Vice President Garner. At one luncheon each month, members of the delegation were permitted to bring occasional guests, either VIPs from their districts who happened to be in Washington, or Washington notables. But such invitations were issued sparingly. Says James H. Rowe, who spent a lifetime in the inner circles of power, "It was a great honor to be invited. I think that in a lifetime I got there 5 times, or maybe 6. At the other luncheons, guests were generally not permitted, no matter how important they might be. It was understood that these luncheons were for business, to plan strategy or to iron out differences within the delegation so that Texas would present its customary united front. You couldn't bring guests except on that one day, Congressman George H. Mahone of Lubbock recalls. That was the unwritten law." Lyndon Johnson did not obey this law, and he violated it in a manner particularly infuriating to the other members of the delegation. He invited to the closed lunches not only his constituents, but theirs. On one Wednesday, for example, Amon Carter, Jr., son of the publisher of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and the paper's editor, James Record, were in Washington, and they asked Fort Worth's Congressman Wingate Lucas if they could come to the famous delegation luncheon. But Lucas had once before asked Sam Rayburn for permission to bring an influential constituent to a closed session, and had been refused. "There was no one I would rather take," Lucas says. "These were my 2 key supporters, but it was a closed session. I told them I couldn't take them. I went to the luncheon, and I was sitting there, and Lyndon Johnson walks in, and who do you think was with him? Seeing Lucas, young Eamon waved at him. Lucas sheepishly waved back. Johnson was able to violate the law because its enforcer was Rayburn, the delegation's leader. Rayburn was customarily very strict about the no-outsiders rule, because the outsiders were, he knew, likely to be the big businessmen and lobbyists he hated. But when Johnson asked permission to bring a guest, Rayburn frequently gave it. Another unwritten but very firm law prohibited a congressman from interfering in the affairs of other districts. Johnson did not obey this law either. Asking the White House for an increase in funding for the Reserve Officers Training Corps at Texas A&M University in Luther A. Johnson's 6th District, he wrote that although the university was not in his district, it is mine by adoption. And when federal grants were given in other districts, even grants for projects with which Johnson had had absolutely no connection, his tactics could be even more irritating. Normally, if a project receiving a grant was located in a district with a Democratic congressman, officials of the federal agency giving the grant would telephone that congressman so that he could announce it, and thereby get credit for it. If the project was in Texas, however, Johnson's friends in the agencies would often telephone him instead, and it would be Johnson who made the announcement. I had been pushing for an extension of the Public Health Service Hospital in Fort Worth, Lucas recalls. Lyndon hadn't had anything to do with it, but when it came about, Lyndon announced it without even bothering to notify me. And even when agency officials notified the district congressman, they notified Johnson as well, and the efficiency of his staff, coupled with his long cultivation of the wire service reporters, ensured that it was his name, not the other congressman's, that would be attached to the announcement. A lot of the delegation was sore as hell, says the AP's Lewis T. Tex Easley. They were, in fact, so sore that Johnson found it expedient to beat a retreat, but only a partial retreat. He realized it was getting them too mad, Easley says, so after a while he would announce it jointly. The shift didn't do much to alleviate tensions. After several joint announcements of federal projects in Corpus Christi, Dick Clayburgh, his former employer and the friendliest of men, could scarcely bring himself to nod to Johnson when they passed in the halls. The ill feeling engendered in the Texas delegation by such tactics was exacerbated by Johnson's personality. His efforts to dominate other men succeeded with one or two fellow Texans, most notably quiet, unassertive Representative Robert Pogue of Waco. But with most of the delegation, tough, successful politicians in their own right, they aroused only resentment, as did his efforts to dominate every room in which he was present. As he strolled through the House dining room at lunchtime, acting as if he were some visiting celebrity, nodding to left and right, head-huddling with one man or another, or as he sat at a table, talking too loudly, other congressmen muttered under their breaths. Albert Thomas of Houston would sit staring at Johnson, snarling sotto voce, "Listen to that son of a bitch talking about himself." Other mutters were occasioned by what Lucas calls insincerity. Johnson was so insincere, Lucas says. He would tell everyone what he thought they wanted to hear. As a result, you couldn't believe anything he said. Ewing Thomason of El Paso had served in the Texas legislature with Sam Johnson, and initially had gone out of his way to befriend Sam's son. Approaching Thomason in the dining room one day, Lyndon Johnson promised him his support on a controversial issue. "Ewing," he said earnestly, "if there's anyone you can believe, it's me." Then he swung across the room and started talking to several congressmen who happened to be opposing Thomason on the issue. Thomason muttered, "There's that son of a bitch telling them the same thing he told me." Mutter though they did, however, few cared to raise their voices, for they didn't want Sam Rayburn to hear them. Rayburn had this very strong feeling for Lyndon, Lucas says, and that feeling protected Lyndon. Nobody in the delegation wanted to get Rayburn mad. The other members of the delegation understood why Johnson was making speeches and friends all across Texas. He certainly made no secret of the fact that he wanted to be a United States senator, says George Mahone. who, without such ambitions himself, was tolerant of Johnson. Chatting with Mahone in the cloakroom or walking back to the Cannon Building with him, Johnson would frequently pull out a newspaper clipping dealing with local conditions, not conditions in Austin but in Houston or Dallas or Lubbock. He would always have an editorial from the Dallas paper or the El Paso paper, and he would sit down next to you on the floor of the house and tell you or ask you about it. Influential citizens from other districts were cultivated not only when they were visiting Washington, but back home as well. He solicited speaking invitations from cities all across Texas, and, Mahone says, when he was in town, he would court them, he would call them up, and of course if someone important like a congressman calls you up, you're flattered. Mahone began to realize that in my district, which was almost 300 miles from Johnson's, he had made friends with the key people. He courted the right people in the right places all over the state. He had statewide ambitions from the day he came up here. But Lyndon Johnson's fellow Texans saw no possibility that those ambitions would be realized, at least not for years and years. Neither of the state's two senators, Tom Connolly and Morris Shepherd, both in their early 60s, was considering retirement, and their immense popularity made remote indeed the possibility that either would be retired by the electorate. Should one of the two seats become vacant for some reason, Lyndon Johnson would not be the first choice to fill it. That would be Governor Allred, who wanted the job, or any one of the several other state officials with a statewide reputation. Johnson would not be first even among the state's congressmen. Several would be more logical choices, most notably Maury Maverick, a White House favorite, or the energetic and ambitious Wright Patman, who was widely known for his authorship of the Patman Bonus Bill and several pieces of populist legislation. There was, in the view of the Texas delegation, no realistic chance of a junior congressman competing with such figures, particularly not a junior congressman from the 10th District. The isolation of that district, the expanse of empty plains that surrounded it and cut it off from the rest of Texas, had kept its congressman unknown in most of the huge state. Says a Dallas political figure, "I'd never even heard the name of Lyndon Johnson at that time." None of the Texas delegation saw the real ambition, a goal toward which a Senate seat, like a congressional seat, would be only a stepping stone. Had they seen it, they would have scoffed at it, and not only because of Johnson's youth and lack of power. While Texans would later maintain that their state was more part of the West than the South, during the pre-war years they regarded themselves as Southerners, and among Southerners on Capitol Hill it was an article of faith, bitter faith, that no Southerner would ever be President of the United States. When, in 1946, his congressional colleagues gave Sam Rayburn a car, the plaque on it would read, "To our beloved Sam Rayburn, who would have been President if he had come from any place but the South." But no member of the delegation saw the true goal, not even a glimpse of it. When, in fact, his congressional colleagues were discussing the possibilities of a Southerner obtaining national office, Johnson would aver that there was no chance of that, and that a Southerner would be foolish to leave a secure seat on Capitol Hill to try for national office. "This is our home, this is where we have our strength," he would say. Others did see the real goal, despite him. George Brown, of course, knew after that day on the blanket at the Greenbrier, when Johnson turned down wealth in the interests of some unstated ambition. Roe, who was keenly observant in his quiet way, and who spent more time with Johnson than any of the other young New Dealers, says, from the day he got there, he wanted to be president. And one time at least, Johnson did reveal himself. One evening, alone with Welly Hopkins, he burst out, "By God, I'll be president some day." But even the few who guessed the goal at which Lyndon Johnson was really aiming could not imagine how he could ever realize it. A Senate seat was not the only path to it. National power of another type, behind-the-scenes power, might help him along the road. But men conversant with such power, the young New Dealers he had cultivated, could not see how he could possibly obtain some of it, at least not in any foreseeable future. They were his friends, but they were only young and junior members of the administration. The fact that he was also young and junior was emphasized by the difficulty Corcoran had experienced, trying to get him even a few minutes with the president to obtain approval of the Purdenalis Electric Cooperative loan. As soon as he had arrived in Washington in May 1937, Johnson had attempted to capitalize on the glow of the Galveston meeting, using every possible opening, no matter how slim. During 1937, he requested autographed pictures, not only from the president, but from the president's son, James, from Presidential Secretary Marvin McIntyre, from every White House staffer he had met, however briefly, and the requests were accompanied by reminders of the circumstances of his election. Sending a copy of the Galveston photograph to My Dear Marvin, Johnson noted that, "This photograph was taken shortly after my election to Congress in the hot fight over reorganization of the judiciary." And by reminders of his loyalty. His letters referred to Roosevelt as the Chief. On Christmas Eve 1937, he had delivered to the President, to his son, to McIntyre, and to other White House staffers, the huge turkeys, so big they seemed to have been crossed with a beef, accompanied by carefully composed notes. "Dear Mr. McIntyre," one said, "the other day I went up into the hills of Central Texas, where I was born, to pick out the finest turkey I could get my hand on for the President. I'm asking my secretary to deliver this turkey to you at the White House for the President. And I want to tell you that one of the reasons my own Christmas is so pleasant and joyous is due to the fact that with a million things to do, you have also had time to take a youngster on the hill under your wing when he needed it, and to give him a lot of help, encouragement, and advice. I am very grateful. Most sincerely yours, Lyndon." McIntyre, who was fond of Johnson, was his soft spot on the staff, and he worked on him. But while Mac may have been flattered by a request for an autographed picture, he could do nothing for him without his boss's approval, and whatever the reason, whether the president had been irritated by Johnson's boasts of intimacy, one Texas newspaper said that the president regarded the Texan as one of the banner carriers of the administration, whether he felt that Johnson was pushing his slim acquaintance, the president appears to have felt he had done quite enough for a freshman congressman. In September 1937, McIntyre agreed to try to do some small favor for Johnson. Its exact nature is unclear, but had to write him, "I regret very much that I have been unable to accomplish your desire." Replies to Johnson's recommendations on presidential appointments, for Governor Allred as United States Solicitor General, for example, were form letters, perfunctory and noncommittal, letters not even from the president but from one of his secretaries. Flatter though he might, Johnson could not flatter his way into the presidential presence. As late as June 1938, a year after he had come to Washington as a congressman, he still had not seen Roosevelt personally. When at that time he attempted to secure through McIntyre his first appointment, for 5 minutes in the next 5 or 6 days, to see the jovial companion of his Texas train trip, McIntyre apparently had to tell him that his request had been turned down. Worried, for Allred had asked him to present in person an invitation to Roosevelt to attend the dedication of a public works project in Texas, and Johnson did not want to confess to the governor that he had no access at all to the president, he made on June 8th a formal written request to Roosevelt for 10 minutes on Thursday or Friday. He was given an appointment for August 15th, and before that date arrived, the appointment was canceled. The PEC audience in September 1938 did not improve the situation. In succeeding months, Johnson, despite requests, did not get through the door of the Oval Office again. During his first 2 years in Washington, that was his only audience with Roosevelt. On Capitol Hill, developments were very discouraging. He might be a member of Rayburn's Board of Education, but in the world of Congress, where seniority ruled with an iron hand, without seniority even admittance to that select drinking society meant little, as Johnson heard the very first time he attended a meeting of the Naval Affairs Committee. The committee's chairman, Carl Vinson, was from the little town of Milledgeville in Georgia's Red Clay Hill country. He had not yet been nicknamed the Swamp Fox, in tribute to a mastery of legislative stratagems which Southerners compared to Francis Marion's mastery of guerrilla warfare, but he had already been nicknamed the Admiral, in recognition of his autocratic manner in dealing with the admirals of what he called my Navy, whom he humiliated by pretending he didn't know their names while ordering them around like cabin boys. With members of the hated, quote, upper house, unquote, and with the 26 members of his committee. Slouched down in the center of the two-tiered horseshoe of committee seats in the committee room on the third floor of the Cannon Building, his glasses teetering on the very tip of his long nose, chewing on the shredded remains of a 10-cent cigar, spitting at the spittoon that was always nearby, dressed in a collar two sizes too big and in baggy, food-stained suits. He looks, one reporter was to write, like the country lawyer he is, and about once removed from the Cracker Barrel. But he ran the committee, in the words of another observer, like a dictator. When, at that first meeting, Johnson, seated on the lower horseshoe among the junior members, began questioning a witness, along with the junior member sitting next to him, young Warren Magnuson of Seattle, Benson gaveled the hearing into recess and said, as Magnuson recalls the words, "I want to see you two boys in the back room." In his small, bare private office behind the hearing room, Magnuson says, "He let us have it." "We have a rule in this committee," the chairman said. "New members were not allowed to ask so many questions." In his first year on the committee, a member was allowed to ask one question. In his second year, two, and so on. The admiral may have been exaggerating the rigidity of his rules, but not by much. "He runs a tight ship," other members warned the two young men, and on that ship, seniority was the standard. Junior members he addressed as ensign. Only after some years, and only after the member had pleased him with his deference and silence, would he be promoted to commander. "When the admiral starts calling you captain," the other members told Johnson and Magnuson, "you know you've arrived." And no one arrived quickly. Attempting to buck the admiral's system was useless. If you tried to collect information for independent judgments on naval affairs, the Navy wouldn't give it to you, and neither without specific permission from Vincent would the committee's own staff members. If you tried to rally other committee members behind an independent stand, you would find the task all but impossible. The favors Vincent had to dispense, not only the small favors like the junket to Mexico City on a Navy plane, but the big favors like the location of a naval installation in your district, were denied, usually forever, to a committee member who had incurred his displeasure. Once a new member, currying favor with Vincent, came up to him after a session and said, "Well, I voted with you." Vincent replied curtly, "What the hell do you think I put you on this committee for?" On that committee, its members said, there are no disagreements at all. And if you tried to go outside the committee and challenge a committee report on the floor of the House, your chances of winning such a vote, from members who might also one day want installations and other favors, a promotion or a transfer for a friend or a constituent, for example, and who were, in any case, under the control of other committee chairmen, were all but nil. Congress, one observer was to write, had given Carl Vinson a blank check to operate as a one-man committee on naval matters. On that committee, only one voice mattered, the chairman's soft Georgia drawl. Lyndon Johnson's voice, in other words, would not matter until he became chairman. Vinson's arrogance was not unique. Most of the great standing committees of the House were run by men answerable to no one in Washington, not to the membership of the House, for it was not popularity with their colleagues, but only seniority which had given them their chairmanships. Not to the leadership of the House. For once the leadership had placed a chairman in his job, it was all but powerless ever to remove him from it. Not to the president, and certainly not to the members of their committees. And they ran their committees like men answerable to no one. A little more than a decade earlier, one chairman had faced down a rebellion in his committee by declaring, "I am the committee." Under the rule that one House leader was to call the strongest and most compelling of all rules, the rule of immemorial usage, that declaration was still true in 1937, as it would be true for decades to come. To observe the House of Representatives was to observe what absolute, untrammeled, unchallengeable power did to men. The House as a whole was run the same way. The sprawling 435-member body was an oligarchy whose ruling circle consisted of no more than a score of men. The Speaker, the majority leader and whip, the most powerful committee chairman. And the only qualification that could secure a congressman admission to this small select ring of power, even if he was, like Johnson and Patman, allowed to drink with its members, was seniority. Ability wouldn't get you into that select circle. Energy wouldn't get you into it. Only age would get you into it. There was only one way to become one of the rulers of the House, to wait. And, harshest fact of all about Congress, even waiting was no guarantee. On naval affairs, the wait would probably be long, for Vinson, who had come to Congress in 1914 at the age of 30, was now one of the youngest chairmen, in 1937 only 53 years old. As a Southern Democrat, he could probably hold his district indefinitely. As long as the Democrats held Congress, he would be chairman until he died or retired, an event that might be many years away. In fact, it would be 28 years away. Vinson would be chairman until 1965, when he retired at the age of 81. Chairman of the Naval Affairs Committee, and then, after 1946, of a new committee which combined naval affairs and military affairs, the House Armed Services Committee. And Vinson's departure would not, of course, make Johnson chairman. If in 1937 he turned in his seat on the lower horseshoe, he could see above him a whole line of faces, the committee's senior Democratic members who sat on Vinson's left, that stood between him and the chairman's gavel. Since he was the committee's most junior member, the one last elected, the one with the least seniority, even the Democrats on the lower horseshoe, even the 32-year-old Magnuson, stood between him and the chairmanship. Some of the Democrats would lose their seats, some would die, some might become senators, but with the exception of those who left the committee in these ways, he would, in effect, have to survive the chairmanships of all these men, the chairmanships laid end to end before he became chairman. And, of course, even if he waited out all those chairmanships, he might still not be chairman. The Democrats wouldn't always be in control of Congress, and if, when his turn in the Democratic line finally arrived, the Republicans should be in control, he wouldn't be chairman then either. Because the Democrats had taken control of the House only 5 years before, after 12 years of Republican control, evidence of this harsh fact, of what might happen to him even if he waited, was everywhere before Johnson's eyes. He couldn't help being aware of all those Republicans who had waited patiently during the 12 years of Republican rule, and of course for long years before that, as the Republicans ahead of them died or retired, who had inched on their committee's dais, chair by chair, toward the only chair on that dais that mattered, and then, just as they were about to reach it, had, in an instant, had the chair snatched away from them as their party lost control of the House. A young congressman such as Lyndon Johnson could see such men, old now, pausing for breath as they climbed the long stairs to the Capitol, or napping in the large, overstuffed chairs in the cloakrooms after lunch. It was so easy to sink into those big chairs and have lunch brought to you on the solid trays that fit across both arms, instead of eating standing up at the counter in the cloakroom so you could get back to work. There were even a few who were turning senile, and who would sit in the chamber hour after hour, staring into space, refusing to retire gracefully, still hanging on year after year. Or he could see men, Democrats, who had finally reached the chairmanship, but so late in life that it no longer meant much to them. Another congressman, Donald Riegel, who in 1966 came to Congress at 28, the same age as Lyndon Johnson, would see the same thing. Some of these chairmen can't hear very well, can't see very well, have difficulty working a full day. He would muse about what it meant to him. A man can come to Congress when he's 35, serve here 20 years, and emerge at age 55 as the ablest man on his committee. But because he has to wait for all the members ahead of him to either retire or die, he may have to wait another 20 years before he becomes a chairman. You will climb to the top of the ladder eventually. The only catch is that you may be in your 70s when the big moment comes. And he would describe also his feeling that nothing would change the system, for the men who would have to change it had invested too much of their own lives in it. Having waited so long for power, they would, now that they had it, do nothing to dilute it. Congress could be a trap as cruel in its way as the Hill Country, a trap with jaws, the system called seniority, strong enough to hold fast even Lyndon Johnson's ambition. In 1938, a year after he came to Congress, Lyndon Johnson made an effort to break out of that trap. The only House committee in which a junior member was anything more than a cipher was Appropriations, and of all the House committees, only Appropriations had the power to fund government programs. Other committees could authorize a program, but the money for it had to come, in a separate bill, from Appropriations. The Appropriations Committee therefore had unique power. More important to a young congressman such as Johnson, its members were divided into 13 subcommittees, each of which had autonomy unique among House subcommittees. Because of the diversity of appropriations work, it had to cover the whole range of government operations, not just agriculture, say, or defense. The members of each subcommittee became the experts in the field it covered, and the committee chairman, 80-year-old Edward T. Taylor of Colorado, customarily deferred to its decisions. Even more important to a young congressman, these subcommittees were small. In 1937, most only had 6 or 7 members, and their smallness kept the meetings informal, so even an initiate had a chance to contribute something, and members with a few years' seniority often were allowed considerable input. A congressman, even a junior congressman, who was named to appropriations, would become automatically, if not a power in the House, at least more than one of the herd. In 1938, the traditional Texas seat on appropriations fell vacant, and although George Mahone wanted it and had seniority, Johnson tried to step into it, planting newspaper stories hinting that his close administration contacts would enable him to use the appropriations post to obtain more federal projects for Texas. But he never had a chance. The Texas seat would be filled by the Texas delegation, and on that delegation, Mahone recalls, Mr. Rayburn had the power. Although Mahone knew of Rayburn's paternal fondness for Johnson, he never worried about the result. Whatever Rayburn said went, he says, but Rayburn followed the rules. And the rule that mattered was seniority. I was the senior Texan who wanted the spot, Mahone says. I was in line for it. If you were the next man in line, you got it. That was the way the unvarying rule was. Mahone got it, found the immediate rewards he had expected. Even as a new member of appropriations, he says, if you were on appropriations, you were courted by other members, and began the climb to greater rewards. In 11 years, he would be chairman of his subcommittee. In 26 years, at the age of 64, chairman of the full committee. For his remaining 15 years in Congress, until he retired at 79, he would be a power on Capitol Hill. Johnson didn't get it. He remained a member of the Naval Affairs Committee, a junior member of a committee on which junior members were limited even in the number of questions they could ask. Hardly had he arrived in Congress, moreover, when an event occurred which apparently convinced him that, even if the long, slow path to power in the House had been the only one open to him, it might not be possible for him. The speech that Sam Ely Johnson gave for his son was the last speech he ever made. His heart had been failing for years, and in July 1937, 2 months after his son's election to Congress, he suffered another massive heart attack, and the doctors told Rebecca it was just a matter of time. He was taken to the Scott and White Clinic in Temple, Texas, where more modern medical facilities were available than in the Hill Country, and he was kept there, often in an oxygen tent, for the next 2 months. But when Lyndon returned from Washington during the congressional recess of September and visited his father, Sam asked to be taken home to Johnson City. Lyndon protested, but Sam said, "Give me my britches, Lyndon. I want to go home where people know when you're sick and care when you die." Lyndon checked him out of the hospital and drove him home, where, on October 23, 1937, 12 days after his 60th birthday, Sam Ely Johnson died. The next day he was taken to the Johnson burial ground on the banks of the Pardinalis, the only acre left to the Johnsons from the Johnson Ranch that Sam had tried so hard to keep in the family. The burial ground was about a half mile upstream from the house to which he had brought Rebecca when they were first married. It was about 100 yards from the gully big enough to walk elephants in, that Sam had filled and refilled with soil in a vain attempt to grow cotton. He had asked to be carried to the burial ground, not in a modern hearse, but in an old-fashioned one, in one of the tall hearses with the carved wooden draperies covering the side glass that had been used before the invention of the automobile. One had been found in San Marcos, mounted not on a wagon but on the bed of a Model T Ford, and it clattered out of Johnson City and down the side path to the ford across the Pardinalis, through which Sam had, as a young man with dreams, so often spurred his horse on the way to the legislature in Austin. Governor Allred was riding, with Secretary of State Ed Clark, in a car behind the hearse. Clark, anxious to curry favor with Lyndon Johnson, had persuaded the governor to attend. Since the two men had been told so many times by Lyndon that his father was only an impoverished drunk, they had thought that the funeral would be poorly attended, and that they would be doing the new congressman a great favor. Therefore, they were surprised when they reached the river crossing. Across the river, the bank of the Pernalis was covered with people as far as the eye could see. The cars that had brought these people, pulled up in a long line behind the crowd, were dusty with travel. Most of the crowd was old people, Stella Glidden recalls. You know, people that Mr. Sam had gotten pensions for. Some of them had come a long way. One aged widow, so crippled by arthritis that she hadn't left her house in 5 years, had insisted that two of her sons carry her out to their car and drive her from their lonely ranch in Marble Falls. Some had come farther. Members of Sam's little band of legislators had come to say goodbye to the man who had fought beside them for the people. One, R. Bonner Ridgway, lived in Dallas. He had heard of Sam Johnson's death only the previous day and had driven all night, almost 300 hard miles, to be at the funeral of a man he had not seen in years. There were uniforms on the riverbank, for Sam Johnson had gotten pensions for veterans of the First World War. No one had ever realized for how many until they saw how many elderly men in khaki were standing stiffly at attention as the tall casket rumbled across the river. And not all the uniforms were khaki. It was on the riverbank that afternoon that Ava Johnson Cox saw for the first time, standing at attention, several old men in shirts and light blue riding breeches holding funny-looking hats, like a Stetson, but not quite, and realized she was seeing uniforms that had charged up San Juan Hill. And there were uniforms much older even than those of the Rough Riders. Five Confederate veterans had donned their beloved gray uniforms and pinned to them medals, bright from decades of shining, of the lost cause. To honor the man who had managed to secure the meager monthly stipends that had meant so much to them. Five, I remember the number, Ava says. I can see everyone in my eye now. You almost never saw those uniforms anymore. The service began, of course, with Shall We Gather at the River, the sound of the singing from hundreds of voices carried up and down the lonely Pernalis Valley. And although he cannot remember exactly what was said, one of Allred's aides was to recall 40 years later his astonishment when the minister, during the eulogy, listed Sam Johnson's accomplishments. "Why, do you know," the aide said, "he had done a lot in the legislature, and it was him who'd gotten built that road we drove on from Austin that day. I'd never heard one word about that. I had thought he was, well, you know, to tell the truth, just some old drunk." The service ended with a few words from one of Sam's friends, a raw-boned old Texas politician, Railroad Commissioner Lon Smith. The words were taken from Hamlet. "He was a man. Take him for all in all, I shall not look upon his like again." A moment of tension occurred after the service when Sam's immediate family, alone in the Johnson home, was sitting around the dining room table with Lyndon, in his father's chair, disposing of his father's personal effects. Lying on the table was Sam's heavy gold watch and chain, his most prized possession. Lyndon's three sisters and his brother, Sam Houston Johnson, had said hardly a word, but when Lyndon reached out and started to take the watch for himself, Lucia, the youngest and meekest of the sisters, put her hand on his arm and stopped him. "No," she said, "you can't have the watch. That belongs to Sam Houston now. Daddy wanted him to have it. We all know that." Rebecca took the watch and handed it to Lyndon's younger brother. Sam Houston Johnson was to write. It was an embarrassing moment for Lyndon, and I felt sorry for him. As a matter of fact, I wanted him to have it because he was the older brother, but I didn't press the point for fear of antagonizing my sisters. On Christmas morning, 1958, more than 20 years later, Sam Houston wrapped the watch and gave it to Lyndon. He recalls telling his brother, "I want you to have the watch. Daddy really wanted you to have it. Anyway, I'm liable to leave it somewhere." Several years later, Johnson's staff began collecting family mementos for the Lyndon Baines Johnson Library. Johnson, who had a keen awareness of his place in history, had carefully saved hundreds of items, including some very unlikely ones. But his father's watch could not be found. If he did not inherit, at least not immediately, his father's watch, Lyndon Johnson believed he had inherited something else. He had always been so deeply aware of his remarkable physical resemblance to his tall, gawky, big-eared, big-nosed father, and his father's habit of grabbing a listener's lapel. A long-standing belief within the Johnson family held that Johnson men had weak hearts and died young. Now his father was dead of heart disease at the age of 60. To the heredity and humiliation which had shaped Lyndon Johnson and had spurred him harshly forward was added the spur of fear. He entered one of his periods of deep depression, one that lasted for several months. It was punctuated, as were periods of crisis throughout his life, by illness. Twice in a span of a few months he was hospitalized with what is variously described as bronchitis, pneumonia, or nervous exhaustion. During this period, when friends attempted to cheer him up by discussing with him the topic which was ordinarily of deepest interest to him, his future, Johnson, whenever reference was made to the possibility that he might have to make his career in the House of Representatives, would reply in a low voice, "Too slow, too slow." Rayburn had begun trudging along that path early. He had been only 30 years old when first elected to Congress in 1912, scarcely older than Johnson was now. He had become a majority leader in 1937, when he was 55. He was still not Speaker. Sam Johnson had died when he was 60. And what if the Democrats should lose control of the House before Rayburn's chance came? The path to power in the House, the silence, the obeisance, was not too narrow for Lyndon Johnson, who could follow sure-footedly the narrowest political road. But it was too long. He had managed to break out of the trap of the Hill Country. He might not be able to escape the trap of the seniority system before he died. This book is continued at this point, on the other side of this cassette.